Hey, and welcome to another episode of Blue Screen Brothers. And apologize again, we tried yet one more time to get a Norwegian podcast, and they did insist, and it almost made it halfway there. But we are live at Microsoft HQ at Building 122 in Redmond. And with me, I have my peer Norwegian security MVP, Sanna. Hi, Sanna.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Tell us something about yourself for our new listeners.
Yeah, so, well, my name is Sanna Deana, working as a consultant within security and mainly focusing on Azure security. So, yeah, that's a bit about who I am and what I do and focusing on.
And our main subject today, the startup, is our, you're a Microsoft FTE, and we met before, we had some podcasts before, it's Brian Sanderson. Give us a brief introduction of who you are for our new listeners.
Sure, sure. I'm sure some of the listeners have heard some of our podcasts or watched some of our podcasts before. I've been at Microsoft for over 20 years. I started at Microsoft back in the 90s when the World Wide Web was just starting to explode, and I was very fortunate to be at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, of all places, where...
I only heard Champaign.
Yeah, well, Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, where the first World Wide Web browser was created. Many of you have heard of the story of Netscape and the folks that left the Supercomputing Center and formed a company and commercialized the web browser, but you probably haven't heard a lot about the people that stayed behind that actually picked up the pieces and took the code base for what was then NCSA Mosaic and continued it for several years and also helped commercialize it, worked with people like Microsoft, among many other companies, but Microsoft also licensed NCSA Mosaic code back then to start their Internet Explorer browser. And
yeah, because despite all the jokes, I know Sanna know all the Internet Explorer jokes, right? But despite all the browser jokes, Microsoft did not have a browser until sometime in the add-on of Windows 95. So there were no web browsers in Windows 1, 2, 3, whatever. So it was only at Windows 95.
That's right. I think that's there were some interesting projects internally, and that were released in some form. I think Word, Microsoft Word, had some HTML editing capabilities really early on. There was a lot of little Skunkworks projects and little things going on at Microsoft around the web, but really Windows 95 was sort of the main point where everything just kind of came together and it became part of the operating system.
That could be a homework task for Paul Eric to figure out which add-on to Windows 95 had the first version of Internet Explorer.
Or maybe could read HTML as a the word browser might be something else, but editing HTML or interpreting HTML, where was the first time that happened?
That's an interesting thing. Because
that would be fascinating.
You could browse the web via command line. It would look horrible, but you could.
We used to have Gopher. I don't know. we're really aging this conversation. I'm looking at Sanna, and she's like, what are all these things? I wasn't even born back then.
No, it was before my time.
Definitely. Yeah. But I think what's interesting to talk about is, when I jumped onto the NCSA Mosaic project and dove into the code, I was a developer at the time, and I was really learning about writing code in C and C++. And one of the first things I did with the browser is I went in and redid the memory management, because a lot of people didn't realize that when you allocate memory when you're developing, it takes a lot of time, and your performance is going to go down. So I one of the things I really am most proud of about what I did when I took the code over was to make it way more performant by managing memory better than the previous folks who had written the code. And today I think about, I've been getting back more into coding, which is a little bit of a surprise to me because it's been some years since I've been a developer. I've been in sales now and working on sales enablement in Surface and now with cloud endpoints that are in Windows 365 and Intune Suite and Intune, quite a ways away from developing code. But recently, there's this thing that's really started to happen with artificial intelligence and ChatGPT and Microsoft Copilot. And amazing things have started to come out that once were like unimaginable. Me going back to writing code is one of those things. Like I didn't ever think I would get back into it. When I was learning to write code, I was learning C and C++, maybe a little bit of C sharp before I stopped programming. So I feel like a little bit of jealousy of the people that are learning to code now with JavaScript and Python and all these new languages and
It's quite funny that you're looking at Sana and at me when you say that you're jealous of the new people.
But what's interesting to me, I mean, among many things, you know, I've been using Copilot now for quite a while. I mean, not that long, really. I mean, the last time I think that we talked in a podcast from Oslo, AI wasn't even on our brains. I don't think we even said the word AI in our conversation.
I think we were starting to debate if it was too soon to cut support for Windows 10.
Yeah, exactly. So, wow, so much has happened in such a short amount of time.
It feels like it's at least a generation ago since you did not speak and talk about AI. And seeing that Sana is still here, so did they talk about anything else at school? Or was it just AI?
No. It was not
just AI, right? No, so the AI revolution have really. First of all, I think it's fair to say that AI is not something new. Anyone who worked in the computer science industry or programming industry know that. So the Turing machine was a very analog way of kind of crunch numbers and do things manually. You could argue that it is intelligence because it does a specific task very well. But one of the very first computers that was ever made with a objective programming language was with Josef Weizenbaum back in the 60s, where he created this program on ELISA, the doctor program, where you have this very small display, almost the size of a smartphone these days, and you could type to the computer and the computer would respond with a prompt. A lot of people thought that was intelligence, so the American Psychology Association thought that this would revolutionize the psychotherapy and the market in the US. But Weizenbaum, frustrated and tore in his head, he's like, this is just an array of responses that is available and it looks for keywords. So for more than, well, it's got to be 60 years then. So 60 years, we had some sort of intelligence. But what's new is the large language model. And you've been playing around with this, Sana, the ChatGPT, the DALL-E, creating images. And what's your experience now?
Oh, first of all, I have to say, like, it's commercialized, so everyone can use it. It's so great and easy to access and to use. And, like, you're just using your natural language and punch it in and then it does everything for you, like whether it's creating images, if it's creating text, if it is also in the space of coding as well. You can get generated code for whatever you want to do and create programs and also when we talk about a bit of the security part, you can also write exploits. You could also actually do look into to the code if you have any vulnerabilities and stuff. So yeah, it's amazing to see just the last 2 years, like everything's been happening in this space and how easy it's become and especially like with the copilots that we see from Microsoft now, it's just we're going into different ball games when it comes to what we do, how we work, and yeah, so
You mentioned security aspect, and I find this very interesting, because when you start debating on any subject, there are people that are pro or they're con. Do you want iPads in classrooms? Are there too much iPad in classrooms? Should they read books, paper book? And a lot of people think that AI is a scary thing. And I say that just as a knife or a shotgun, it's either a tool or a weapon, the same as AI. And from a security perspective, you have a hard time supervising, managing, and keeping all of your ecosystem safe, because ecosystems have grown since the 90s, right?
Yeah.
So you have to move malware via floppy disks. But nowadays, you could have a million infected devices in minutes. And you could either use AI to create malware or to target attacks, or you can use AI to remediate and inspect to see if something suspicious is happening there. Have you seen into some of the security features there?
Yeah, and also a challenge which we're faced with is also that so much gets automated, so you can't really just trust what you get. You need to also verify that it is valid, and also because what you're dependent on when it comes to these tools with AI tools is the data behind it, and also that you need to make sure that the data behind it is valid, and it's not manipulated or gives you like a wrong direction. So this is a challenge in many aspects of it when it comes to security. Of course, like you say, you can use it for good or for bad, but also another challenge is that we're so heavily dependent on the data sets behind it and how that will affect what you're getting out of it and if you can trust it or not.
And you've been playing with this for quite some time, Ryan.
Yeah. I've been fortunate to have access to Copilot for some time.
Yeah, you work for this small company.
Yeah.
This small startup called Microsoft.
And I've been using M365, Microsoft 365 Copilot for some time, and it's extremely it increases my productivity. It's like extremely impactful on my productivity. But I've also been using other Copilots, right? The GitHub Copilot, for example. And Sana, you mentioned trust but verify, and I think it's an interesting question. You know, today when I use GitHub Copilot and I ask it to write a function, or it sometimes says, "Oh, I think you probably want to write your function now," and it starts inserting code. And I learned sort of the hard way that, you know, something that looks so seemingly obviously implemented correctly has sometimes some tiny little bugs in it. And I remember once I was just going through and removing some entries in an array, and the function that Copilot gave me seemed to work, except that there was one thing missing, and that it was using a loop. And it was going through and basically it was skipping some of the rows that it should have been deleting.
That's a good loop.
And then I said, I highlighted the code and I said to Copilot, "I think there's a bug here in that it's skipping." And of course Copilot says, "Oh, you're right, there is. Here's what you need to do to fix it." Well, why didn't you give me that in the first place? I spent 2 hours debugging my code, and it was because of what Copilot gave me that caused me to spend those extra 2 hours. Now, over time, ultimately, I've been saving a lot of time using Copilot. But occasionally, there are these trust but verify. So I think one of the interesting questions to ask is, how soon will it be when that trust goes up, where we don't have to be as diligent about the verification and the answer is actually correct? That's an interesting question. Because today, in order for an LLM, in order for a ChatGPT, in order for Copilot to be successful, it's got to get you something useful most of the time. And I think we're definitely there. Like, otherwise, it would not be exploding the way it is.
I've heard a good analogy here, and that's the AI is like a naive toddler. So it always wants to please the master or its parents. So it gives you things and hope for the best. And most of the time, so if you ask a kid, hey, go and pick me some flowers, you're going to get weed back, right? So you're going to get dandelion and whatnot. So not the prettiest of flowers, but they hope that it solves the problem. And said, you need to prompt back and say, not those, I want tulips. So you need to be more clear and specify more. And you mentioned the training and the grounding and how much more you need to put into this. I think we now have reached where AI for the last 60 years have been an infant and a toddler. Mm-hmm. Now we're sending him or her to school. So now all the big corporations are starting doing the machine learning algorithms. They're doing the grounding, they're doing the LLMs. So now it's starting first grade, maybe second grade. So now you got to see the start of the potential of what it could be in the future if you properly educate the AI. So for what projects have you been using it? You mentioned something that you're going back to coding.
Yeah.
Are you making a new browser?
No. Definitely not. There's plenty of niche browsers out there, and many of them are quite performant. I don't have to worry about going in and checking their memory usage to make them faster. I think that the browsers are very strong. For me, there's really been two things. One is in my professional work, I've been able to use Copilot to help me solve some work problems. And there's this tool called Power Apps, Power Automate. And before Copilot, it was a little bit of a step up. And I like to compare. I have a chemistry degree. as well as a computer science degree and such. But I like to compare Copilot to like a catalyst in a chemical reaction. There's this thing called the activation energy that you need in order to get a chemical reaction going. And once you hit that, the reaction just goes. And I feel like Copilot is adding acting as a catalyst to raise the activation energy for all of us to become more productive. And what I mean by that is for me to start using Power Automate to actually work through some challenges that I might have. It was a pretty significant step up. I had a few colleagues who were a little bit more ahead of me and tried to teach me those things, but I couldn't feel like I could ask them a million questions. But with Copilot, it's a very patient teacher. You can ask it every question. It doesn't say I'm tired of working with you. It doesn't have a schedule. You don't have to book time with it. It's right there, and it answers your questions immediately in real time. And you can ask it to go into more depth. You can tell it, hey, I'm a second grader. Tell me how to do this. Give me a step by step. There's all sorts of different things, and Copilot really helped launch my Power Automate scripting, and once I was able to get going, I was able to solve a number of things in my team and working in sales enablement that I wouldn't have been able to do without it.
It's super interesting because there's like a couple of years ago, there was this buzzword that was floating around. It was no code, low code, and they would make everyone a developer. So you didn't have to be a coder. You didn't have to do a bachelor or master's in computer science or software development, because now we have low code, no code, and Power Automate and Power Apps, and all of these would be a catalyst for that. But now you have what smartphone did for people, turning everyone into Andy Warhol or Steven Spielberg, because now everyone can take a good photo. Now everyone can make a good movie. I see amateurs making better movies than I've seen in Hollywood based on their iPhone and iPhone only. And now Copilot is making everyone a developer. And if you combine the GitHub Copilot with the Power Automate, you really don't need any code skills, do you?
I hesitate to say, because I feel like there is still a little bit of understanding that you need today. I think it gets back to the question, how far are we from being able to just ask Copilot to write something, and then it asks us a few clarifying questions and outputs what we wanted in the first place? You know, and I'm going off on a tangent here again, but there used to be a time not too long ago when people said, oh, the prompt engineers, that's the new job. The job of the future is to be a prompt engineer and to be able to engineer how you write and interact with ChatGPT. And I think that's crazy. I think the ChatGPT is going to get faster and better and more able to understand our intent and perhaps even ask us questions to clarify, where we won't need a prompt engineer as a job. Today, yes, you kind of got to
do it's going to be a short-lived education, yeah. That one. Yeah, you get a master's in prompt engineering, all right, you're obsolete.
Yeah, yeah. You're going to be obsolete pretty quickly because I think the AI is going to catch up and it's going to be able to. So today, right now, I think in order to use Copilot, it's really sort of like the calculator was in school when I was in school. It was an assistant. It helped take some of the hard like problems out of my chemistry and my physics courses.
Or even the repetitive tasks.
And so, the repetitive
yes,
tasks.
So, yes. So the hard ones or the repetitive ones.
But I think in the not too distant future, it's probably not that far away. I figure AI is today where the internet was in the 90s when I just taking that back to the web browser days, where we were in the 90s, which exploded the .com era. I think we're really in that era now for AI, and it's just going to explode. I think we're going to be able to say, I need a Power Automate script that does exactly this, and the AI will be able to give you that.
We talked a bit about that in the car over here, Sana. We mentioned that each decade have kind of, in a technology manner, it's have been one revolutionary thing, at least since the 90s, but even maybe before that. But in the 90s, you could always argue that it was Windows, but it was really the web. So you get access to the web. And it did take some time, but in the 2000s, you got the smartphone. So you got portable computers, not laptops. You got portable computer. You could always argue that laptops were also adopted during the mid-2000s. And then you had the 2010s, where it was all about the cloud. And it feels like it was a decade. Oh, wait, it is a decade ago. But the talk about the cloud was so massive, and now we take it for granted. Is AI the thing of the 2020s? And if so, what's going to be the 2030s? The prompt engineers is probably not the answer.
No, I don't think so.
But is AI going to automate all of this for us, Brian? Do you see any way out of that?
You know, I hesitate to try to guess just because I'm so blown away by where we are today in such a short amount of time where, yes, you're right, AI has been for a long time something. I mean, I took courses on artificial intelligence, but the LLM and frankly, it's worth talking about. Like the people that write LLMs don't really understand how it works. They don't know what is actually happening.
It's almost like the chestnut they say about the brain. If the brain was so simple we could understand it, it would be so simple that we couldn't. So I think LLM is the same way. It's so huge and there's so many modules and it's starting to interact with itself in ways we don't really fully understand. And for those who are trying to grasp that part a bit more, I'll see if we could peer pressure Donna Sarkar to get into one of our podcasts to explain the LLM, because that's what she does at Microsoft. Uh-huh. So that's the LLM module. But there's a lot of interesting thing going there. But for what purpose do you use now? So let's say you work with a browser memory optimization. You used it for work for a Power Automate script. What else have you been using Copilot for?
Yeah, I mean, in my personal life, I used to code and enjoy that, and I've kind of missed it, and so recently I've been working on a game, just a little game.
Are we gonna find it on Steam?
Probably not.
Probably
no,
not.
Probably
right.
not. It's mostly just a personal endeavor, but I've really enjoyed going back and. Learning Python and learning JavaScript through Copilot, because I know what I'm a developer by intuition, but I don't know the syntax for Python, or I didn't know the syntax for a lot of JavaScript. I knew syntax from when I was in school, but Copilot makes that transition so much easier. And to me, what's just the little the explosion of light bulbs in my head is when I'm working on a bit of code and Copilot has a little chat. There's a number of different ways you can access it, but there's a little chat say, I need a function that does this. And bam, it writes the code. And that to me is just mind-boggling.
But you got a new calculator because writing all these functions, so let's say you want to do something and all the setters and getters and all the static things, you've already written it 1,000 times. So why do you want to do it again for 100 different times? Just the same thing, repetitive tasks. So you've now got a calculator helping you offload those repetitive tasks.
Yeah. And last night I was writing some code and I got to a number of if then else kinds of statements that were going to need to be repetitive. And Copilot figured out pretty quickly what I was doing. And within a few seconds, it just said, oh, here, I think I know what you're doing. And it gave me the repetitiveness, the repeated parts of what I needed to do. And I just had to hit tab and accept what it did. Of course, I verify what it does now because I do not always trust everything that it spits out.
You really got zero trust a new meaning here. Verify explicitly. Yes. So we could even add Copilot or coding Copilot as zero trust. Don't trust the Copilot. Verify explicitly.
And that goes for anybody who's listening who's like ChatGPT in general. Any large language model today, certainly, We've not touched on politics. I don't want to touch on politics, but you know, elections and social things. AI has the potential to disrupt, and it's a little bit scary without going into too much of the scary parts.
Oh, let's go into this. No, we're not going to go there.
No, it's a deep dark hole to go into. But you still need to verify the things that you're getting from any of your AI models. They're still based on human input, and human input is fallible. There is lots of stuff out there. I was recently using Copilot to convert some VBA scripts, part of my macros in Excel, because I needed to move them to OfficeScript. And Copilot was really happy to convert my VBA scripts, my macros, into Office TypeScript.
I need to get you some drugs. You don't do macros anymore. That's definitely
exactly,
sure. Yeah,
exactly.
Ibuprofen good enough? Yeah, all right.
But, you know, what it spit out, it hallucinated. It invented functions that don't exist. And part of that is because it was trained on multiple different versions of TypeScript and OfficeScript, and maybe it saw at some point that there was this function that existed. But the bottom line is trust but verify. And I think for the foreseeable future, we're going to need to be doing a lot of verification. But I do still think that over time, we will get to a point where the verification part is less drudgery. Because today is kind of drudgery. You have to verify. You can't just believe what you're told. But I think over time, the verification step will not be as necessary as we train better and better to get better output.
I think that is something that I believe Sana can feel related to this as well, because getting on board on something new, you could say that you used to study and program in C and C sharp, et cetera. There's not that many developments that are being written in those languages. But if you are introduced to a program that you need to fix, or you're getting into a project, or if you're getting into some area of the social aspect that you have no idea of, like, do you want a 20-amp or a 30-amp socket in your wall? How should I know? You could ask and get input from the GPT, that it helps you bring you up to speed on the stuff you should know, but you really don't have any groundwork for doing it. And have you ever used Copilot or ChatGPT to kind of, what is this, Sana?
Yeah, and also just to add on a bit with the security part of it, where you have to verify it and go back and forth. It's also that what you're getting out if you don't have the knowledge around it and how it can affect your code or the system where you want to run it, if you don't have that knowledge as of today, then you can't just go blind out with that. So you're in need for using this. You're also in need in the broader picture. But going forward, that is really like interesting, because then you might don't need that background information or that that knowledge, because the ChatGPT or the co-pilots will have that for you and be based on like a broader perspective and not as much as the biases that we encounter today in the co-pilots or other.
It's quite interesting to see they talk a lot about fairness, inclusiveness, and non-biased and everything, but that often turns out that it make it hard to replicate the truth a couple of years ago. So if you tell Copilot to create an image or create a story of parts of our history, like the Crusades and the medieval ages, or you talk about building the pyramids, create me a picture of someone creating the pyramids, first of all, they all have laptops, so that's highly inaccurate. Second of all, they often turn out not to have this skin color that is accurate for the people who build the pyramids. And we see that trying to tutor the AI to both be inclusive, fair, and non-discriminating, but still being accurate of what was the truth for that time.
Yeah.
Do you see any do you have any approach on that?
Yeah, that's a bit touching on what I'm saying, that then you as the user of those models need to know and have that understanding to actually be able to pinpoint that out. Okay, yeah, back in those days they didn't have a computer, or the ones building there, they had different skin color. So you are in need of that knowledge to actually verifying is that correct or not. But going forward, when these models gonna be even better trained on a broader set of data, they will be able to give a correct feedback that you could trust in a stronger way. But here also is the challenge that the data that you're feeding it in, you also need to make sure that data is correct. Because if that data is not correct, the what you will be prompted back again will be based on wrong data from the first place. So
we're still talking about that toddler at school, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you give them the wrong idea in and they're going to get out of school with the wrong idea out.
Yeah.
So I think the groundwork here is the key takeaway, but I think we're on time. I see some people are trying to get the room from us and they're getting out. But is there anything that we would like our listeners to take an extra deep dive on when it comes to development? Is there any tip you would like to give them, Brian?
Wow, there's so much to leave on. I mean, I think if you haven't explored ChatGPT and large language models, if you haven't explored Microsoft Copilot, which is very accessible, you know, you just go to bing.com and there's the Copilot button. If you haven't yet explored those, I really strongly recommend that you do go play around with this. This is where the world is going, very fast, very rapidly. From all sorts of different corners of the world, I'm in a genealogy group on Facebook, for example. My dad is very much interested in looking at family history and the amazing things that large language models have brought to that community, the community of people that are looking at history and looking at family connections. It's amazing. Today, when you try to, a lot of that genealogy is reading handwritten notes. You know, they didn't have computers back then to keep everything nice and clean.
No one's able to read my handwritten notes, that's for sure.
But there are AI models that probably can, and yeah, it's really amazing how far that those communities are making. A place where you would never expect artificial intelligence to have an impact, but really it does. It has a huge impact. And I would challenge anybody who's listening that it's going to have an impact on everybody. It's all around. It's pervasive. It's going to have an impact, and I think a positive impact in most cases.
Maybe we should challenge our listeners to write a comment on what community or society or aspect of their life have been affected by AI, just like you said on genealogy, because that was something that was out of the world for me until you brought it up. Mm-hmm. So what is being affected? We all know photography, video editing, but what other aspects of life have been altered?
Yeah, I look forward to reading people's comments because I'm sure we'll all learn something. It's just, it's amazing.
Yeah. All right, so thank you so much, everyone, for listening in. And, of course, thank you so much for, again, taking the time to chat with us, Brian. I really appreciate it. So thank you so much for listening.